We have with us live in the studios this morning, Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
And as we had announced last week, Jav is off.
He's out traveling.
To like Arkansas or something.
He was actually off to, I believe it's Tennessee, and he's driving back. So he's in Arkansas right around now on his way back home.
Driving as fast as the roads will let him. So he should be back next week. Uh-huh. So talking about the economy this week, going to start out with that, something that's near and dear to everyone's heart, except apparently the administration.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the question that everybody has on their mind is, well, we had a war and the war was supposed to help the economy, but the economy is still in the dumps. And why is that? I think the answer should be pretty plain, that the economy has more fundamental problems than a few problems that a war might help, that increased defense spending might help. And some of those problems include some reports were highlighted by some of the economic reports that came out this week, including one that showed that consumer bankruptcies, individual bankruptcies, had jumped by a record amount, something like 7.4% year over year, which is the biggest increase since they've been keeping records, since the bankruptcy courts have been keeping records on personal bankruptcies. But personal bankruptcies, you have to understand, have been increasing every year throughout the 1990s and into this century. So this is not new news, but it is a drastic show that a lot of people out there who should be spending money to help bolster the economy are actually in front of the bankruptcy court judge saying, I've got nothing to spend. In fact, I'm so deep in debt, I need help.
So 7.4% of the population?
No. Oh. It increased by 7.4%. Oh, okay. But that's still millions of people who have declared personal bankruptcy just in the past year.
Okay, and would these be average people?
These are just individuals, yeah, average people.
As opposed to the head of Enron or something?
No, we're not talking about just the head of Enron. In fact, those guys seldom declare bankruptcy. They can usually go and leverage more money. They can go and borrow more money in general, either from family or friends or from the banks. Usually they can go to a bank and say, look, I'm worth this much. I have these assets. What can you give me to help me get by for the next 6 months? Those guys can usually find more money to borrow. I'm talking about middle-class people, lower-class people, people who have charged too much on their credit cards and then gotten sick and their health insurance won't cover a $50,000 operation or $400,000 for their cancer treatment, that sort of thing. Those are the people who are in front of bankruptcy court and who are losing all of their assets except for their house, although with new bankruptcy laws coming through, that's going to be houses may even be on the line eventually with the bankruptcy reform legislation that's passing through.
All right. And what other...
So there's been some other stuff going on, too. I want to talk a little bit and remind people about that this economic downturn's been coming for a while and why it's not going to end very soon. What you need to know, too, is that it's not just consumers that are not spending money right now. It's also companies are not spending money, manufacturing companies, service companies. And it goes clear across the spectrum. I mean, auto manufacturers, airplane manufacturers, textile, the food industry, heavy equipment, high tech, they're all in a slump right now. And that's because of overcapacity. Now, that term is used a lot, and I just want to explain it a little bit. Overcapacity can mean anything from maybe having an extra warehouse that you can't fill with goods to go to market. It can mean extra factories. It can mean extra equipment that you bought that you don't have the capacity to use because you're not getting enough orders in. It can mean too many employees that you can't keep busy enough. All of those things refer to overcapacity. Now, companies have to do something to deal with overcapacity. Sometimes if the orders are not coming in for a seasonal reason, for example, say it's the couple months after Christmas and stores are not restocking yet or consumers are not out spending, then companies can usually weather a short period of overcapacity. But the overcapacity has been going on now for over a year, possibly 2 years for some sectors of the economy. And what businesses do to cope with that is they lay people off. So they take people who most of their employees probably have a high debt load already. They turn those people out on the street. There are not a lot of jobs available for them. And so those people, you know, declare personal bankruptcy or they go on, they subsist however they can. They move back home with mom and pop, that sort of thing. And that puts a damper on consumer spending. People don't have the money to spend, and people who still have jobs are worried about getting laid off, and so they don't spend as much anyway. And they sit at home, they save their money, or they try to pay down their debt, which is what's happening. So when businesses have overcapacity and they don't have the money to spend on buying stuff, more equipment purchases, more jobs for people, then they lay off workers. They try to sell equipment in a market that's already flooded with other companies trying to sell equipment and not many buyers around. And consumer spending goes down, and you get this spiral of nobody really buying anything, and so the economy goes into a slump. Now, there's usually a way to get out of that, and that way involves the global economy. We usually rely on other countries, people in other parts of the world, buying up our extra capacity, our extra equipment, or investing in our real estate. If a company has bought too much real estate and needs to sell a factory, needs to sell a warehouse, needs to sell an office building, we've usually relied on foreign investors coming in and considering the U.S. market a safe market and buying up properties and equipment, even coming in and opening offices and hiring our citizens to work for them. And we rely on people around the world to consume our goods, people in Europe and in Japan and China, in other parts of the world, to buy American products or American services. Now, the problem is that there's been a global downturn for a number of years. Started in the mid-90s when Japan's economy tanked. As people now think that it was because of a banking crisis, it was literally very, very similar to our current problems. In Japan, there was too much lending to companies that didn't have good-looking balance sheets, or the balance sheets that they showed were fictitious. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
And the banks went into a banking crisis, and Japan's economy did just what I'm explaining to you now. Businesses had too much debt. They couldn't pay off their bills. Their economy sunk. They laid off people. Those people couldn't spend money, and they went into a deflationary spiral where prices for goods dropped to try to lure people in to buy them. But consumers were worried about their job security and about their future, and they didn't buy anything, and so prices dropped lower, and what you get into is a deflationary spiral. And Japan's been in an economic downturn for almost a decade.
Difference there is in Japan, when the CEOs mess up, they actually apologize to people later. Here they go on like the talk show circuit and write books.
That's right. or they just go looking for another job in another industry.
Yeah, maybe they go work for the current administration.
Uh-huh. In the public sector.
Yeah, or go over to Iraq and run things there.
Uh-huh. They give advice on how to turn Iraq's economy around, or set up the new economy in Iraq.
So the rest of the world isn't looking so good.
So it started with Japan, and then if you remember back to about 1997 to 98, when the Asian economic crisis hit, that was when the other Asian tigers in Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Taiwan, Philippines, all those other countries that were considered the tiger economies at the time, when their economies tanked as well. And it was for the same reason. You had overcapacity. You had banks lending to big real estate developers and businesses to expand and expand and expand, and they produced a lot of stuff and nobody bought it. Or they built a lot of warehouses and a lot of office buildings, and there was nobody to occupy them. And so the Asian economies collapsed, and it was such a large collapse, and it involved banks that were not just within those countries, but banks that were related to or were branches of Western banks, that it created a ripple throughout the world. Investors as well, who had invested in the Asian tigers, took their money out and put them in places like Latin America and in Russia. And the ripple spread to those countries as well. Russia went through a collapse, if you remember. I believe that was late 98. And then Latin America followed on its heels. And then a couple years later, the U.S. economy started to falter. So it really is a ripple that started with the Asian economic crisis and has finally reached our shores. Excuse me. And now we would be looking to two places to bail us out. One would be Europe, but Europe is going through its own economic problems right now. Germany and Italy, two of the biggest economic engines for the European Union, are looking at a recession right now. They're just on the very tip of a recession. And the other economy that would probably help bail us out would be China. China was insulated from the Asian economic collapse because they weren't fully integrated into the global economy. And so they hadn't been borrowing money from Western banks. They hadn't been relying much on the Western capital institutions that other countries had. And so they were largely insulated from the Asian economic crisis. But in the intervening years, they've become more and more integrated into the global economy. And now Chinese consumers consume a lot of products that the United States, your U.S. companies produce, and that European companies produce, and Japanese companies, and so forth. However, we've had in the last year, we've had the SARS outbreak, and we've had problems with global terrorism, which has made travel to China and travel between countries in Southeast Asia pretty much closed down now. And if you go to China and or you talk to people who are living in China, they will tell you that the markets are closed, that nobody's buying anything, there are no people hanging out in malls in places like Taiwan, which has, I believe, the second highest or the third highest SARS infection rate now behind China and Hong Kong, that those three places, which would help by consuming our goods and help bring us out of this economic crisis, those three places, people are not buying anything, and it's largely because of this epidemic going on right now. And it's not going to change anytime soon, because that not buying doesn't just affect us, it also affects the Chinese economy, and it affects the economies of Taiwan and Hong Kong. They're going to lose quite a bit from this as well, and they're going to be looking at helping themselves, not necessarily consuming globally. It's what happens in any depression or recession anywhere in any single country, is that the people at home in that country decide that the first items they give up, the first things they stop buying, are the expensive imported goods. And they concentrate on staples, things that they need, like food, like health care for their kids, like school supplies, the things that they only absolutely need, or they concentrate on paying down their debts.
All right. School supplies like staples.
Yeah.
Okay. So it doesn't sound like there's going to be any recovery from any of this soon if the whole world's kind of hurting.
Yeah, the whole world is literally hurting. And the problem is, there are some ways to pull out of this. One way might be to take, because we do still, I mean, we're an immensely rich country. We do still have a lot of money. People do still pay their taxes. The government has a lot of money. Right now, the Bush administration is frittering it on a useless war, and they're spending it on useless kill toys. That defense spending is not going to help the economy. It's probably the least efficient way to bring us out of an economic slump. There are much, much more efficient ways. If the budget writers in Congress had decided that if they had really looked at one of the best ways to bring the U.S. out of a slump, it would have been to foster real jobs, not phony jobs like a dividend tax cut. Will not foster jobs. I mean, nobody thinks that. Not even economists in the right wing of the economic spectrum think that a dividend tax cut. Nobody thinks that a dividend tax cut will create jobs, except maybe George Bush. Maybe he believes that, but I think he probably doesn't believe that even either. That's just the gimmick to sell the package. If they really, really did want to create jobs, they would look at more public spending. They would look at ways to hire more teachers, at money to give to state governments to get them hiring. They would look at ways to get small businesses off the ground and operating. They would look at ways to really create jobs, but that's not what's been going on at all.
So we can't expect any help from there in the near future. So, so where do we turn to our state?
Well, we can look at the state budget deal, because right now here in Washington State, we have had some agreement on at least a portion of the budget in Olympia. Budget negotiators in both the Senate and the House convened on Monday, and they basically said, okay, we're not going to call the rest of the state legislators back to session until we have something of a budget deal. So it was just been the budget negotiators sitting in Olympia trying to hammer it out. They came to some agreement on the income side of the budget. Now, you recall there's two sides to the budget. There's the income side, which you take in, and there's the expense side, which you pay out. Now, they agreed on the income side of the budget, and the Democrats lost, as we would expect, nearly all of the tax increases that the Democrats wanted on tobacco, on cigarettes, on candy and gum, all of those have been tossed by the wayside. And instead, we have something that's very close to what the Republicans had proposed, which is let me see. Just want to make sure I have my numbers right. What the Democrats gave up was something like $359 million in tax increases, which they would have put towards restoring some of the things that Governor Gary Locke cut out of the budget. Now, the Republicans said, no, we won't go for those tax increases, and we won't go for an increase in state gambling either, so that $359 million gets cut out of the budget. In addition, the Republicans, as a trade-off, said that they would not renew about $115 million, which is really a pittance, $115 million in business tax exemptions. Now, what the Republicans did, though, is they managed to get the Democrats to agree to set aside about a $300 million reserve of money that won't be spent this year. It'll just be sitting in a reserve account next year when the legislature convenes, to be spent on whatever the legislature thinks will be necessary at the beginning of next year. And that means that the Republicans are going to use that to try to restore those business tax exemptions that they didn't renew. So in essence, there's a one-year, a small number of business tax exemptions have been repealed for 1 year. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that the Republicans have given up as far as the budget is concerned, whereas the Democrats gave up probably a total of about $442 million in increased taxes that would have been spent to help people on the basic health plan, to help children, to help with adoption services, to help people who are on supplemental Social Security and need that income from the state. All of those people will now be cut off. Although right now the two sides need to sit down and talk about where exactly the cuts are going to be, because the two budgets don't exactly agree in that respect. So they still have to hammer out the expense side. But they've come down to and agreed on the income side, and essentially the Democrats have lost and the Republicans have won.
All right, and then when they're done hammering and this disfigured thing takes shape, then they take that to the entire body there, and
yeah,
they vote on it?
They get a package that the two sides can agree on, and then it has to be voted on in both the House and the Senate and passed. And it's generally by the time that the budget negotiators have agreed on a package, that means it's going to pass. It's very seldom that it doesn't pass both houses at that point. And Governor Gary Locke will definitely sign it, because it's very close to what he proposed at the end of last year.
All right. And how long would we expect this to take? Because didn't last year or last time around, didn't it take forever for them to...
Well, right now they've agreed on the major piece, which was the increased taxes was the big stumbling block. And now that the increased taxes are largely cut out of this and the Republicans have gotten what they wanted, it's going to go very quickly, I think, as far as the expense side is concerned. So I don't think it's going to drag on a whole lot longer.
So, and how that will affect you and me and the average person listening will be that just a lot of those more of the support things that we had in the past are disappearing.
Yeah. It's going to most especially affect low-income children, I talked a little bit about what was being cut out of the budget in the last couple of shows, and those things are pretty much going to all be cut out now. Looking at the budget as it's being proposed, there's not a whole lot that can be restored with the little bit of money that the Republicans will get from that business tax, from halting those business tax exemptions for a year. That's not going to provide much.
Okay. Anything else on that?
No, but I think we should move on and talk a little bit about the federal tax cut package.
Okay.
Because that kind of relates to this too. Now, the states, nearly all the states in the union have had the same problem. They have to balance their budgets. They can't do deficit spending, most of them. By law, because of their state charters, they all have to balance their budget. So if they don't have enough coming in, they have to make cuts somewhere. The federal budget doesn't work that way. The federal government can issue debt instruments in order to basically put it on a charge card, in a sense, when they want to spend more than they take in. And the Bush administration has been doing just that. They've been very, very happy to charge and spend. We talk about the Democrats being tax and spend. At least the Democrats balance the budget. The Republicans charge and spend and don't care about balancing the budget. Now, the federal tax cut package is a big part of that. The federal budget passed a while ago allowing at least somewhere between a $350 billion to a $500 billion tax cut was assumed when the budget was passed. And now the House and the Senate have been working on what the actual tax cut will be. That's what this federal tax cut package is all about. And the House has its version, and the Senate has its version. Now, the House is controlled by Republicans. They passed a $550 billion tax cut that included cutting the dividend tax rate for the richest Americans, well, for all Americans, but rich Americans get about 80 to 90% of the dividends in this country. And their tax rate will go down from 38.6% to about 15%, which is probably about what someone who makes, $20,000-$30,000, that's about what their tax rate is. And the bad part about the House package is that it also cuts capital gains taxes, which are at 20%, down to 15% too. So in the House package, rich folks, their two main sources of income, dividends and capital gains, which is what they make when they sell their stock or they sell their assets like a house or some investment real estate. Their two main sources of income are now being taxed at a rate that you would expect, say, a family of four with $20,000 would pay. Or, you know, family of four, middle class family of four with, you know, maybe two incomes that equal about $60,000 would pay as much or more than what a rich person who makes millions and millions and millions of dollars will be paying under this House tax cut package. It's just an enormous giveaway to the rich. Now, the Senate, on the other hand, which is controlled by, just barely controlled by Republicans, they have, I believe, a single vote majority in the Senate. They had been arguing over whether or not a tax cut was necessary and what kind of shape that tax cut should take. That's where the real battle has been playing out. And there are moderate Republicans in the Senate who just thought that the dividend tax was an enormous fiasco. They said, why are you doing this? This is running up the deficit. It's not going to create any jobs. It's an enormous giveaway to the rich. I just don't think we can get away with it. However, they did signal to the other Republicans that they could be bought off. And their price tag was the thing that they could be bought off with was aid given to the states. They were basically looking at this saying, well, we can't justify this huge tax cut package and a high deficit when the states are going begging. They have to balance their budgets, but they don't have enough money. The federal government should be helping them out. Which is true. The federal government should be helping them out. You know, it's a sinking economy. The states are having a rough time. They can't deficit spend. They should be getting help from the federal government, which can deficit spend. And if you're going to deficit spend, what better reason to do it than to help out the states and try to boost the economy at the same time? Now, you have to understand that the tax cut package the Senate passed would provide $350 billion. It's a $350 billion tax cut. However, it's going to be much, much more over the long term, because the Senate tax cut package will cut dividend taxes to zero for 3 years, from 2004 to 2007. So instead of cutting the dividend tax rate to 15%, cuts it down to zero. So no taxes for rich folks on their dividends. No taxes at all. Now, that is supposed to expire in 2007, after 2007. But there's no way that Congress is going to take that away. There's just no way.
Right, like those sunset clauses on the Patriot Act.
That's right.
Don't worry, we'll take those off later.
No, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. They will renew it every year, or when 2008 rolls around, they'll make it permanent. So it's much, much bigger tax cut than $350 billion. Now, what did the states get in exchange for that? Well, they may get $20 billion spread out over 50 states. That's not very much money. I think Washington State's share of that is going to be about $400 million, when our budget hole was $2.7 billion. So the states are getting a tiny, tiny pittance, and that's if, when these two very different budget packages from the House and the Senate go to committee to be reconciled, just like our state budget is being reconciled, and these two tax packages go to a committee of the whole to be reconciled, that might be cut out. And I think there's a very good chance that that state aid, which allowed some of the more conservative Democrats and the so-called moderate Republicans to vote for this Senate package, saying that, gosh, you know, here we're giving the rich this huge tax break, but we're giving some money to the states. I think that $20 billion aid to the states is very, very likely to get left on the cutting room floor.
Wow. So we might get $400 million, which would cover, if we spend it on one thing, would cover 2/3 of what Mayor Nichols is proposing for the South Lake Union area, but they're probably not going to actually give that to us. So, but we still will get the $350 billion cut for the rich.
For the rich, yeah.
Uh-huh. That's sweet if you're the rich.
It's sweet, yeah. If you're
somebody.
But
for the rest of us, we're
who works for Microsoft and is a millionaire.
Well, we're darn near out of time talking about budget stuff. So I'm going to just throw you a quick quiz question here. Mm-hmm. What do Saudi Arabia, Chechnya, and Morocco all have in common?
They are targets.
Not funny, but.
They are targets of Al Qaeda or terrorist groups that sympathize with Al Qaeda or are related to them in some way. And I think from the bombing attacks in Riyadh this week in Chechnya, there were two separate ones in Chechnya, a car bomb that killed at least 41 people and injured almost 200, and a separate suicide bombing by two women in a market trying to attack the Russian puppet leader of the Chechnya government. And then this bombing yesterday in Morocco, in Casablanca, which is a noted tourist city in Morocco. It's really, really points up the fact that the Bush war in Iraq was a sideshow. It had absolutely nothing to do with terrorism, and in fact has given al-Qaeda a chance to reconstitute itself, and given terrorist groups around the world a chance to plan this wave of attacks. And I want to just point out, too, that intelligence analysts who've been talking to the foreign press have been pointing out that the fact that these attacks were all coordinated and are coming at the same time and have all been against similar targets, particularly Westerners in Riyadh and in Casablanca, and then the Chechnya attacks against the Russian targets in Chechnya, that this points out that there has to be some kind of overarching coordination. There has to be some kind of senior leadership that survived the war in Afghanistan, and that the U.S. has not either not been pursuing or has been thinking that these guys are not able to run things, when in fact they actually are.
So we need to look back to a body like the UN to coordinate this if we're really going to get anywhere.
Well, obviously the Bush administration isn't up for it.
Right.
You know, they're busy raiding the Treasury.
Well, with that, we're out of time this week, talking with Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, very quickly, just the contact info for Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. It can be found around town in Seattle at various bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places you find free periodicals. And if you want to call us, you want to volunteer, or you have questions, comments, you can call us at 206-903-9461.